Voice University Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The incoming White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, said Sunday President-elect Donald Trump has accepted the view of the U.S. intelligence community that Russia engaged in cyber attacks during last year's U.S. election.
He's going to order the intelligence community to make recommendations, and whatever those recommendations are will be discussed and actions may be taken. But I don't think there's anything wrong with trying to have a good relationship with Russia.
Mr. Trump, who questioned Russia's involvement, was briefed on the matter from the intelligence community Friday. Republican Congressman Devin Nunes, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said while he's convinced Russia was involved, he rejects the view of Democrats they lost the election because of it.
You know, they lose an election, and then it appears like they want to change this narrative into somehow that Russia was responsible for Hillary Clinton losing the election, and I just don't buy that.
President Barack Obama Sunday on U.S. television said an investigation he ordered convinced him of Russian meddling.
What is true is that the Russians intended to meddle, and they meddled. And it could be another country in the future.
He said this cyber spying is typical of Russian behavior in Europe. Sunday marked the 1,000th day of the Boko Haram abduction of hundreds of Nigerian schoolgirls from Chibok. President Muhammadu Buhari said he remains hopeful the remaining 195 will be rescued. But the leader of Bring Back Our Girls campaign, Aisha Yesufu, said little has been done since the release of 21 girls in October.
The Bring Back Our Girls movement worries that the Nigerian government once again relapsed to the complacency, lethargy, and inertia that has been recurrent on this tragedy.
More than 200 girls kidnapped in April 2014, an act received international attention. This is VOA News. Speaking to French media, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad said his forces are on the road to victory after the fall of rebel-held eastern Aleppo. He said final victory will come when we get rid of all the terrorists, but he lamented the suffering the conflict has caused.
Every war is bad. Why bad? Because every war is about destruction. Every war is about the killing. That's why every war is bad. You cannot say this is a good war, even if it's for good reason, to defend your country for noble reason. But it's bad. That's why it's not the solution.
Government airstrikes Sunday continued to pound the rebel-held Wadi Barada Valley near Damascus, where the city's vital water supplies are located. At least four soldiers, three of them female, were killed and several others injured as a truck driven by a Palestinian slammed into the group of Israeli troops in Jerusalem Sunday. The truck driver identified as Fadi Ahmed Hamdoun Kunbar of East Jerusalem. A police spokesman called it a ramming attack, a terrorist attack. North Korea Sunday said it could test launch an intercontinental ballistic missile at any time and from any location because of what it called hostile U.S. policy. The statement followed the New Year's Day remarks by leader Kim Jong-un that his regime is in the final stage of test launching an ICBM. South Korea has called that a provocative statement. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter on U.S. television Sunday was asked about the North's heavily sanctioned nuclear and missile programs.
Their nuclear weapons and ballistic missile defense programs are a serious threat to us. We try to stay ahead of that, and we are staying ahead of that with our missile defenses to make sure we've upgraded their number, their type, so that we're sure we can defend ourselves. We've deployed missile defenses in South Korea, Japan, Guam.
Carter said the U.S. would be prepared to shoot down a North Korean missile aimed at the U.S. or its allies, but not necessarily a test launch. Iraqi government forces said they've reached the Tigris River that divides Mosul, viewed as a key advance in a three-month campaign to liberate the northern city from Islamic State. Meanwhile, two more suicide bombings in Baghdad killed at least 20. Former Iranian President Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani died Sunday at age 82 of a heart attack. His death coming ahead of May's presidential election is viewed as a blow to moderates and reformists in the Islamic Republic. Mexican authorities have arrested the alleged suspect who shot and wounded an official with the U.S. consulate in Guadalajara, Mexico, Friday. The suspect's name or possible motive have been withheld. U.S. federal law enforcement is involved in the investigation, offering a $20,000 reward for information on the shooter. The American official, identified as Christopher Ashcraft, has been hospitalized, is stable. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Story Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 9th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gambia's foreign-born Supreme Court judges are expected to be sworn in today to hear President Jammeh's election challenge.
You can come and look at the figures and say, look, that Barrow, you have no case against Barrow. You know, he won, you should step down. Or your case is compelling and the evidence is satisfactory for us to say that the election should be redone.
Samsudin Sarr is Gambia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations. The 1,000th day in captivity of the Chibok girls was commemorated yesterday, Sunday, in solemnity. Sierra Leone's main opposition SLPP reorganizes, or is it infighting? And Ghana's new president promises better days ahead.
We must create wealth and restore happiness to our nation. We can only do this when we have an educated and skilled population that is capable of competing in the global economy.
Nana Akufo-Addo is Ghana's new president, who was inaugurated on Saturday, and we'll talk with the professor who got Facebook to add the Fula language. Those stories plus Samson Omale's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Foreign-born judges on the Gambian Supreme Court, mostly from Nigeria and Sierra Leone, and handpicked by President Yahya Jammeh to hear his election petition in Banjul, and are expected to be sworn in today, Monday. The court is expected to begin hearing the petition tomorrow, Tuesday. Samsudin Sarr, Gambia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations, says new election is the only solution to the political impasse. In an opinion piece, Sarr says smart hackers broke into the Gambian election system and manipulated the results. He said Election Commission Chair Aliu Mama Njai did not flee the country for fear of his life, but rather he did so to avoid the embarrassment of facing the Supreme Court to answer questions about the fraud perpetrated in his office.
Yeah, because the whole credibility of the election process was compromised by what I believe were hackers or unscrupulous people who really changed the figures where nobody thought they could. As a result, you know, the elections were not at all fair. They were free, I agree, but they were not fair at all. That is why I believe we should go back to the polls and get a credible electoral commission to conduct it, and if possible, with the supervision of the international community. That's my recommendation.
Are you certain that you believe that the election results were hacked?
I believe they were, because if you look at the numbers, you see the way they even try to explain how the numbers changed from the previous publication. We gave Barrow, the winner, a 51,000 lead to Jammeh, which changed after they made their corrections to 18,000. Still, the explanation doesn't make sense.
Mr. Ambassador, you said in your letter that you believe that the Election Commission Chair, Mr. Njai, probably fled or left Gambia out of embarrassment of facing a Supreme Court where he would have been caught dumbfounded with a serious digital and analogous fraud perpetrated in his office. We heard that the Election Commission said he left Gambia because his life was in danger.
I stand to dispute that equivocally, because I have found out from everybody who could possibly know about a threat being directed to this gentleman, and everybody said nothing like that happened. Nobody threatened him, and it would have been beautiful on our interest for him to come and face the questions and answer them. Why would we threaten him when all we say is that your numbers don't add up, everything has been changed on in a way that raise serious suspicion and justifiable one for that matter, and then you run away and say your life is threatened. I think it's all about being afraid to face a very critical or a very dubious election he conducted.
This week, the Supreme Court is supposed to hear President Jammeh's petition. What do you know? Are the judges already in Gambia or what's happening?
Yes, they are all in the Gambia right now. Tomorrow, they're going to be sworn in, and on the 10th, they're going to look into the whole case, give their recommendations. There are three possibilities. They can come and look at the figures and say, look, you that Barrow, you have no case against Barrow. You know, he won, you should step down. Or, well, your case is compelling and the evidence is satisfactory for us to say that the election is not right and it should be redone. Whatever they come up with, we have to really let them make the decision now.
So what do you say to those who say those judges were recommended by Yahya Jammeh and they are likely to favor him?
Well, it's the same argument that has always been said about the IEC, that the IEC was a commission handpicked by Jammeh and put together, supported by Jammeh, paid by Jammeh and all that. And that throughout, they had always said that you could never win Jammeh in the country because of the IEC's loyalty to Jammeh. Now, Jammeh lost. The IEC is the best in the world. And the same argument now is being said about the courts.
Samsudin Sarr is the Gambia's deputy ambassador to the United Nations. You are speaking with me from New York City. Expectations are high in Ghana as President Nana Akufo-Addo has now been sworn into office. As Francisca Kekra-Folsom reports from Accra, Ghanaians say they want an end to current economic hardship.
Nana Akufo-Addo was sworn into office Saturday before parliament, fellow presidents from the continent, dignitaries, and thousands of Ghanaians at the Black Star Square. The inauguration ceremony was colorful as many Ghanaians adorned themselves in traditional outfits from kente, a popular woven cloth from southern Ghana, and fugu from the north. But an arduous task lays ahead for the new president, who inherits a weak economy with an increasing debt, high inflation, plummeting commodities prices, and the city's free fall. President Akufo-Addo, in his inaugural speech, promised prosperity for all Ghanaians.
We must create wealth and restore happiness to our nation. We can only do this when we have an educated and skilled population that is capable of competing in the global economy. We must expand our horizons and embrace science and technology as critical tools for our development. We will provide vision and direction and shine the light down the path of our entrepreneurs and farmers. We are indeed counting on a vibrant private sector to drive growth and create jobs.
Some young Ghanaians are highly expectant of the prospects of an Akufo-Addo government. Salifu Fatau, a salesperson, says jobs must be top priority.
For the young people, we need work. We need work and good salary. We are looking on him to see to it that he's able to build a lot of schools, a lot of works for we the youth. For now, he has given us his word, so we are standing on his word.
Fadilatu Ahmed, a draftswoman, is concerned about the economy.
I'm expecting the government or our new president to work towards the economy. But that's my main reason why I voted for him. The economy is very bad. When you look at the value of our money, it's very low. The fire crisis, the Dufo-Addo issue is enough. We had enough.
Faustina Dogbevi hopes for lower education fees.
I want the education cost to be at least a bit lower, that everybody can send his or her daughter to school and pay school fees.
The tenure of outgoing President John Mahama saw widespread corruption scandals and apparent shielding of accused officials. The new president sounded a warning against corruption under his government. Francisca Kakra-Forsen for VOA News, Accra.
Today is Monday, January 9th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. In Nigeria, the 1,000th day in captivity of the Chibok girls was commemorated yesterday, Sunday, in solemnity. Boko Haram terrorists abducted more than 200 schoolgirls from northern Nigeria on April 14, 2014. About 200 girls have so far been rescued. President Muhammadu Buhari said his government is committed to secure the freedom of all the girls and reunite them with their families. Aisha Yusufu, a member of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, says she appreciates the government's commitment but wants a timeline for when all the girls will be rescued. She said the 1,000-day commemoration was heartbreaking.
With heartbreak, we had to commemorate the 1,000th day of our Chibok girls being in captivity. And of course, we did a march to the State House, to the seat of power, where the office of the president, President Muhammadu Buhari, is. And we went there, we gave our statement. It was quite a very heartbreaking moment, seeing that our girls have been in captivity for 1,000 days. And the more heartbreaking of it is the fact that there were so many security agencies that were out there and trying to prevent us. So you could see a full-gear anti-riot and all that, this hot water vehicle and a whole lot of things, the personnel that were deployed. There were so many, and we were wondering, in this moment where we are remembering, tragically, our daughters that have been in captivity for 1,000 days, all of that wasn't needed, especially from a movement that for 985 days had conducted affair peacefully, and it's a movement that has remained disciplined and remained focused and has been consistent.
But Aisha, you're not saying that while there was strong security, you're not saying that they prevented you from marching?
No, we didn't allow them to stop us. They tried to prevent us from marching, but we insisted, and we went on with our march, and we got to what we were going to do, and we did it. We have every right to march in the country. We do not need permission from the police or anyone. All we need to do is notify them 48 hours, and we always do that. And for us, it is all about one thing, rescue of our Chibok girls. Today they want us to go home and not come out again and march. All of our Chibok girls should be brought back home.
President Buhari has recommitted himself and his government to making sure that the remaining Chibok girls are free and reunited with their family. Are you satisfied with that?
Well, for now, yeah, when you look at it and say the words and the action don't match. In the statement that the president gave, he did say that he commended those who have been coming out and demanding for both nationally and internationally for our Chibok girls. But now you look at it, when you have security agents being sent down and they say they come from the presidency has said that we should not come out to march, then you begin to wonder what's going on. It is not a matter of saying one thing and doing another.
So help me to understand, did we hear that someone has volunteered to be responsible for the education of the girls that are free, the Chibok girls? I know the president has said that the government will take care of them, but did someone from the private sector make any promise?
Well, for us as a movement, it's something that we cannot make comments on. It's something that we don't have information to, and we are a movement that is consistent in the fact that we want empirical evidence before we'll be able to say or comment on anything. So on that one, I really don't know much about that. For the Chibok girls that have been brought back, the government has denied the movement the opportunity of meeting with them and helping out in any way we can. But for us, it is not about us. It is about our daughters getting the best that they can. Because at the end of the day, when we rescue our Chibok girls and we do not ensure that they get the education that they were taken away from, then we would have failed. So we must ensure that in any way that they get their education.
Aisha Yusufu is a member of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. She was speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria. In Sierra Leone, the main opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP, has denied it is in disarray because of infighting. The party a week ago suspended a number of its members. Some say this is an indication the SLPP may not be ready for the 2018 presidential election. But Inra Sila, acting National Publicity Secretary of the SLPP, said those suspended had been engaged in anti-party activities.
They were expelled for anti-party activities, and it's been ongoing for a while. They haven't basically been conforming to the rules and regulations and the party's constitution. Clause 5A clearly states that it is only the chairman leader who's got the sole authority, as per our constitution, to call a next meeting, and also has the sole responsibility to chair a next meeting. What they did on the 17th of December was to call a next meeting without the chairman and leader, and they got the deputy chairman and leader to chair the meeting, at which they said they resolved it, suspending the chairman and leader from the party. Now, that has not been accepted and received favorably by the vast majority of members of the party. So the chairman, by the powers vested in him from the constitution, called the next meeting on the 4th of January, and next members resolved that those who have been involved in those anti-party activities and bringing the party into dispute should be expelled, and they were expelled accordingly with immediate effect.
So this has nothing to do with some infighting between the supporters of, say, your former presidential candidate, Julius Maada Bio?
Well, it might not be unconnected to that, but, I mean, at the end of the day, it has to do with what the constitution of the party says. Now, I don't know of any organization, probably except the United Nations, which has the Secretary General as the most powerful individual in the United Nations. But otherwise, for every organization, a secretary is not powerful, more powerful than his or her boss. So it hasn't got anything to do, although there are undercurrents of this whole flag bearer thing and the name you mentioned, which are the Julius Maada Bio. But the crux of the matter for me is about following the laws. It's about the rule of law. It's about what the Constitution says. It's about doing what is right for the party in the interest of the party. It shouldn't be about the interest of one individual. And that is where those who took the decision on the 17th of December, that is where they're leaning towards.
So what do you say to those people who say, with Sierra Leone preparing for elections in 2018, that what's happening within the SLPP is a bad indication that your party may not be ready to play on the national stage?
I'm glad you used the word may not. I mean, and that obviously implies that there are possibilities that it could be ready, right? It may not and it may be. We understand that there are challenges right now, and we are trying to make sure we come together. We have to unite, but it has to be unity based on the rule of law, unity based on the constitution, unity based on the rules and regulations of the parties.
Imra Sylla is acting National Publicity Secretary of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. One of the most recently added new languages for Facebook is Fula, thanks in part to Ibrahim Sarr. Sarr, a professor and Mozilla localization team lead for Fula and linguistics specialist, sent an email to Facebook representatives a few years ago asking them to consider providing a Fula version when they finally decided to make the version late last year. Sarr helped with much of the translation. Sarr tells Ricky Stryer why the work is not just translation but localization, and how he finds a way to preserve Fula words through technology.
Usually we use the term localizing because it's not just translating. It's also transferring a lot of things from one culture to another. And then so since I've been doing that, and I've also been using Facebook, so we tend to localize like all the major programs that people use, and Facebook is actually one of the most important things people do on the internet. So I contacted Facebook and asking them if they could add our language. So then they answered me like 3 or 4 months later saying, okay, right now we're not adding languages, but, you know, whenever we add more languages in the future, we will consider your request. And that was that. And later, in March 2015, I got that mail saying, okay, right, we need to know more about your language. Can you tell us how does it call itself? They said that they were going to actually add the Fula to the language. So that was really an exciting moment.
So that was nearly 3 years ago now.
We actually started translating. And it's a huge task actually to translate all Facebook. We haven't finished yet. And also you have a lot of technical stuff to translate, and that's quite difficult.
And what role did you specifically play in the translation of Facebook into Pula?
My role has always been to lead actually teams, be it like at Mozilla or outside Mozilla in the community, because I've had a lot of experience and also studied computational linguistics.
You also mentioned that it's not just a matter of translating, but rather a matter of localization. Can you give me a specific example of a word you had to localize while coding, building this software?
I'll give an example. Maybe that's not specific to Facebook. We have a term in English called aspect ratio. Translating that into Pula was absolutely tricky. And what I did, that's a few years ago, is to go back to the language and use something that existed before, actually, and that has disappeared, but the term is still there. The occupation of my group in the Fula community is we are fishermen, so we make our own nets. We actually weave our own nets. When I was a kid, for instance, my dad would let me knit or two, but I'm not very good because I'm a beginner. And when I finish, when he looks at the net, he sees that they're not perfectly square. And he asks me, this is jendi, it means the aspect ratio is not good. That's what I use for instance, to translate aspect ratio.
That was Ibrahim Assar, Mozilla Localization Team Lead for Fula and a linguistics technology expert. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from France. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, James. We begin with preparations of national team sides ahead of the 2017 AFCON, which begins this weekend in Gabon. Zimbabwe's national football team left Harare finally for the AFCON Cup of Nations on Sunday after players refused to board a flight on Saturday following a row with Zimbabwe Football Association officials over allowances and bonuses. The players are demanding for $5,000 instead of $1,000 appearance fees. The association is offering an $150 daily allowance for locally based players and $500 for foreign based players instead of $50 and $100 respectively. Coach Callisto Pasua prefers not to talk about the feud but has chosen to concentrate on getting his players in the right tactical mood for the competition.
I think on that issue we have the manager. I think he can manage on that. I, as a coach, I'm doing my job in the field like you saw today. Everything in the field is okay.
Willard Kasendi is Zimbabwe's national team captain.
For me, it's more like the team effort. Like I said, if we're going to work as a team, we're going to get it right. And because they do have great individuals, but individuals doesn't make a team.
Elsewhere, the Democratic Republic of Congo have announced their final squad for the upcoming 2017 AFCON. The Leopards included six players who plied their trade in England, with Newcastle United defender Chancel Mbemba making the 23-man squad. Hull City centre-forward Diomaxi Mbokani is expected to lead Leopards' front line during the prestigious continental tournament. Elsewhere, Crystal Palace forward Wilfred Zaha had an impressive start to his Cote d'Ivoire career as he provided an assist in their 2-1 win against Sweden in a friendly on Sunday. After appearing in two friendly games for England, Wilfred Zaha only recently switched his international allegiance to Cote d'Ivoire. And to Tunisia, where that national team side lost 1-0 to Egypt in a warm-up game played on Sunday evening in Cairo. Tunisia is drawn in Group B alongside Senegal, Algeria and Zimbabwe, and they will play their first AFCON match on January 15th in Franceville against Senegal. And Uganda claimed a 3-1 victory over Slovakia in a friendly on Sunday in preparations for the 2017 AFCON. Ugandan coach Milutin Sredojevic says he believes in the squad he's going with to the 2017 AFCON Cup of Nations and says the players still have a lot to learn to make the impact he so desires.
It's very sad, but we are coming to national team, but players, they lack certain things that they have jumped in their football education. They have reached the playing Premier League and playing even professionally, yet certain things are missing.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Over to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, January 9th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Hi, my name is Florence Mwale and I work as a reporter at Capital FM here in Malawi. With the world now a global village, the VOA's place cannot be overemphasized since most of the issues it airs are pertinent to the advancement of least developed countries such as Malawi. All of us here at Capital Radio Malawi are thrilled to be associated with the VOA as a partner station. Some of VOA's programs on our schedule include Straight Talk Africa and Daybreak Africa. As Cabaret Radio Malawi, we are excited to be associated with the VOA. Just last month, a member of our news team managed to have a one-on-one interview with the VOA's James Butty at the height of the protests that followed the US elections. And now, as the VOA celebrates its 75th anniversary, we look forward to more live radio interactions and strengthened relations. Happy 75th anniversary, Voice of America, from Capital Radio Malawi.